Happy Monday. It is the summer solstice, which means that today is the longest day of the year, which is, I think, reason to celebrate. If you're of a negative cast of mind, you might be thinking that that means that the days get shorter from now on, which I try to avoid thinking about because that actually depresses me because I don't like to think that we have peaked out this early in the summer. Our guest today is Eric Edelman, who's an American diplomat. He's been a guest before on this program, a former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and the U.S. Ambassador to Turkey, the U.S. Ambassador to Finland, Principal Deputy Assistant to the Vice President for National Security Affairs. And we could go on, but then we'd run out of time, wouldn't we? Ambassador Edelman, thanks for coming back on. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Charlie. It's always great to be with you.
There are many, many sound bites that we could start with today, including some very serious ones. But I just wanted to start off the week with a former, the former White House physician, is that his title? Ronnie Jackson, who's now a Republican congressman, who has some thoughts about the cognitive health of President Biden compared to President Trump. Let's just play Ronnie Jackson.
We submitted to that. President Trump, as you mentioned, he hit a perfect score on his cognitive test, an outstanding performance. And I'm saying that is the new standard. The precedent has been set, and I'm asking Joe Biden and his medical team to get out there and to get this physical exam done, get this cognitive testing done, and get the results back to the American people. We need to know that we can trust our president.
Yeah, this was that like the camera woman man test or something that Trump took at one time?
I think he took a couple, actually. If I recall correctly, Representative Jackson, when he was then Dr. Jackson, said that Trump could live to be 200.
Yes, that's right.
Which I don't think most physicians believe is possible. What can I say? I mean, if you want to compare Biden's performance at the round of summits he had with Donald Trump, I mean, he didn't shove anybody out of the way to get into the center of the group photo. And as I noted in a column I wrote for the Bulwark about the Biden-Putin summit, none of Biden's staff felt the necessity to either look for a fire alarm to pull or or feigned a medical emergency, as Fiona Hill told NPR she considered, in order to shut down the absolutely awful Trump press conference with Putin in Helsinki, where he said that he trusted Putin rather than the American intelligence community. So, all things considered, I think Biden gave a pretty damn good account of himself when he was overseas compared to Trump.
See, that would have been so outstanding if Fiona Hill had actually done that, you know, had fainted just to stop it. It would have been like a scene from Veep, except that even the writers of Veep probably would have thought that was over the top. So we could talk. I mean, the thing about the Ronnie Jackson thing that, and I suppose this has become a kind of a chronic thing, where you watch somebody who used to be the White House physician saying something this crazy. And the question inevitably comes, how did this person get the job in the first place? This was the guy who was the White House physician when Barack Obama was the president of the United States. He is providing medical advice to people at the highest levels of power. He's handing out pills on Air Force One. And I guess this keeps coming up over and over again. You look at, Michael Flynn. How did this guy become a general? How did he become, you know, is there some weird thing about the vetting process that we don't understand that so many of the people in positions of real power turn out later to be, I don't know, shall we say, since it's Monday and it'll be nice and everything, and I'm still heavily medicated on painkillers, so I'll be nice, that they are eccentric?
Or crazy?
Yeah, that would be the not nice version of it.
Were they always crazy, or did they only become crazy? I choose to believe that the great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick had this notion of contact lunacy, to me that this is just another example of someone who's been affected by close contact with Donald Trump and has walked away, a complete lunatic as a result of it.
I have to look this up. Contact lunacy. This is a thing. Philip K. Dick. I love the guy.
Yeah, no, he was a great writer. And so contact lunacy for me has been the explanation all along, for this effect that Trump seems to have on people. I mean, take Mark Meadows. I mean, that's another story from over the weekend, right? Pushing the Italy Gate conspiracy about, the Italians using, at the request of the American embassy, allegedly, space satellites to change ballots from, Biden to, or from Trump to Biden, and throwing the election. And this was being propagated by some woman who had a camera crew in to talk to her at a mansion, which she claimed to own. It turned out she didn't. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you can't make it up. As you said, deep writers would just say, nah, come on, too unlikely.
No, that's obviously a crazy theory about the Italian satellites, because as we know, those ballots were changed by the Jewish space lasers. Right, so, I mean, we need to understand what is plausible and what is not plausible. Okay, so from the ridiculous to the much more serious, I have to play for you. This is a little longer soundbite than I would normally play, but this remarkable exchange between Jonathan Swan and the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes.
Jonathan Swan is sitting down with, Jonathan Swan from Axios is sitting down with him, and they're talking about anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States and Europe, and the Prime Minister is waxing somewhat eloquent and indignant about anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-Islamic sentiment after 9/11. And then Jonathan Swan turns the focus from the United States and Europe to the whole question of, well, why don't you say anything about what's happening to the Uyghurs, the Muslim Uyghurs in China, right across your border? So I want to play this because it's remarkable. And Ambassador, I want to get your insight into what we're actually hearing here. So this is Jonathan Swan with the Prime Minister of Pakistan.
Just across your border in Western China, the Chinese government has imprisoned more than 1 million Uyghur Muslims in re-education camps. The Chinese government has tortured Muslims, forcibly sterilized them, and they've destroyed mosques in Xinjiang and also punished Muslims for fasting, praying, even giving Muslim names to their children. Prime Minister, why are you so outspoken about Islamophobia in Europe and the United States, but totally silent about the genocide of Muslims in Western China?
What our conversations have been with the Chinese, this is not the case, according to them.
The evidence is just overwhelming.
Whatever issues we have with the Chinese, we speak to them behind closed doors. China has been one of the greatest friends to us in our most difficult times. When we were really struggling, our economy was struggling, China came to our rescue. So we respect the way they are. And whatever issues we have, we speak behind closed doors. How come this is such a big issue in the Western world? Why are the people of Kashmir ignored? It is much more relevant compared to what might be going in the Uyghurs. 100,000 Kashmiris have been killed. There are 800,000 Indian troops which have literally, it's an open prison in Kashmir. 9 million Kashmiris are put there. Why is that not an issue? So I think it's hypocrisy.
They've been a huge partner to you, China. But on some level, doesn't it make you feel sick to have to be quiet because of all this money they're putting into Pakistan?
I look around the world, what's happening in Palestine, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Afghanistan. Am I going to start talking about everything? I concentrate on what is happening on my border, in my country.
This is on your border.
Which is part of... No, that is part of Pakistan. 100,000 Kashmiris are dying. That concerns me more because half of Kashmir is in Pakistan.
This is a grotesquely large human rights atrocity.
First of all, I'm not sure about that because our conversations with the Chinese, this is not the picture
that comes from that side.
No.
Just to put a fine point on this, you are not in any way concerned about the Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
Our discussions with Chinese will always be behind closed doors.
Wow. Okay, so Ambassador Edelman, what did we just hear there? Because it sounded to me as close as I ever thought I would come to hearing a prime minister basically say, yeah, we've been bought off. Our silence has been purchased by the Chinese. What is happening there?
It's a great clip, Charlie. I'm glad you played it. I think there's a lot of things going on there. So let me unpack it a little bit. I think what you hear there is what a great interviewer Jonathan Swan is, among other things.
Yes, definitely.
I am in awe of Jonathan and just think he is one of the best at what he does. Second, of course, one of the things on the surface that you're hearing is, you know, a lot of whataboutism, you know, the Uyghurs, mm-hmm. what about Kashmir, you know, et cetera. That's a longstanding Pakistani grievance, obviously. The other thing you're hearing is, and there's, you know, some of you're hearing, and there's a lot that's not said. So Imran Khan is a Pakistani politician who has traded on anti-Americanism for a very, very long time. So he acknowledged China's longtime patronage of Pakistan, you know, on the basis of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, given the sort of strained Chinese relations with India going back, you know, many, many years. Some of that Chinese patronage, by the way, was assistance to Pakistan's nuclear program under AQ Khan. Chinese played a not inconsiderable role in helping facilitate that development. And so as a result of this Chinese patronage, you know, he's going to take up whatever criticisms he has of China, which is to say not many, privately, but that's not going to stop him from airing his differences with the United States, which has also been a longtime patron of Pakistan, but to be fair, a little bit less, a little more inconstant one than China, but certainly during the Cold War, a very strong patron of of Pakistan. He's quite happy to take, you know, his criticisms out of on the United States out in public. Among other things, he said during that interview, in parts you didn't play, that Pakistan would not serve as a base after the withdrawal of Afghanistan for the United States. And yes, I mean, he basically, you know, was saying, as you suggested, you know, China's helped our economy, which has been a basket case for much of Pakistan's existence on multiple occasions, including recently. And so, yes, we're going to turn a blind eye to their human rights violations. To put it in a bigger picture, I think one of the things I worry about a lot, and my former colleague in government, Ambassador Bob Joseph, and I wrote about this in the Bulwark a couple of months ago when President Biden announced the Afghanistan decision. The Afghanistan withdrawal, I don't think, has taken into account the Pakistan dimension very much. Hmm. Pakistan is a fragile, if not failing state. It's kind of been perpetually failing, frankly, since 1947, since partition. But it also is a nuclear weapon state, and it's producing enormous amounts of plutonium and developing a rather large nuclear arsenal. We've always been, we, the United States, have always been concerned about the potential for those weapons to get out of you know, positive control of the Pakistani government. And one thing that I don't think has had nearly sufficient discussion about the Afghanistan decision is what happens if the Afghan government collapses, absent the presence of U.S. troops and contractors, the difficulty of executing over-the-horizon support for the Afghans. We just saw that, you know, in the last few days when the commander of one of the Afghan special forces units was killed in part because they didn't have U.S. air support. And we tend to forget that right now the biggest, you know, refugee population in the world, of course, is a result of the Syrian civil war, which has been going on for a decade. But before that, the largest refugee population in the world had been in Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion. More than 2 million Afghans living in Pakistan, which did a lot to fuel the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, but also the rise of jihadist movements in Pakistan as well. If you get another huge outflow of Afghan refugees into Pakistan, destabilizing a country that's got a nuclear arsenal roughly, you know, maybe slightly smaller, but on a track to surpass that of the United Kingdom, you know, and that government collapses, I mean, it is going to be, you know, a very dangerous situation. And we're not going to have troops nearby who might be able to try and secure any nuclear weapons that get loose. So I think the Imran Khan interview with Jonathan Swan, you know, raised some very immediate questions about the Afghan withdrawal and about Imran Khan and what's going to be the future of Pakistan, but also some second and third order consequences of the Biden administration's Afghanistan withdrawal decision, which I don't think have been adequately thought through or discussed.
Let's also talk about, I want to go back to China, though. What is China doing for Pakistan that wins this kind of silence, wins this kind of, you know, willingness to not criticize? I guess the question is Pakistan becoming a satellite of China? Is it becoming an ally of China? Is the investment level in China by the Chinese something that we, could match or are not matching? What's going on?
Well, I mean, the Chinese, I mean, have come in, and not just in Pakistan, but in other places as well, and used the fact that they've got a lot of money at hand. They've got a Belt and Road Initiative, which is meant to invest in infrastructure, and it's in certainly in places like South Asia, but also Central Asia, but well beyond that, I mean, into Europe, where they're buying up the Port of Piraeus, certainly in Turkey, where they've been buying up distressed assets, and in Iran, where they signed a long-term economic deal. So this is part of China's predatory economic statecraft. It comes with, in a country like Pakistan, where corruption is endemic, it feeds on that corruption and in turn, makes the economy less competitive. And buys off political elites. I mean, that's part of the intention.
So let's talk about, since we're on the Middle East, over the weekend we had an election, and last week we had an election in Iran, hardliner elected president. Give me your sense of where that takes us. Obviously, this is in part fallout from the end of the nuclear deal that had been brokered by the previous administration. So are we looking at rougher times, or does it take a hardliner to be able to cut a deal with us? What is your sense? Optimistic, pessimistic, challenge?
Well, I think it's an expression of the inner dynamic of the Iranian system. I'm struck, frankly, by how little we outsiders really understand about the politics of Iran. I think there's been a long-standing tendency in the West to break down Iran into sort of categories that we think are comprehensible, like moderate, moderate and reformer. This is what my former boss Bob Gates used to call the search for the elusive Iranian moderates, when in fact, everybody in the political system there is committed to the revolution, the Islamic revolution. It's a what political scientists like to call an electoral authoritarian regime. There is some element of popular sovereignty in the sense that they have elections, but the elections are very closely overseen by this institution, the Guardianship Council, that vet candidates and kicks some of them off the ballot. So most of the serious reform candidates were kicked off the ballot. And then in response to that, the less well-known reformers actually dropped out because they didn't want to legitimize the election. I believe this was the lowest turnout ever in an Iranian presidential election. I believe the official figure was something like 49%, but there's some evidence that even that number was inflated. And I think what that speaks to is the lack of legitimacy, of increasing lack of legitimacy of more than 40 years after the revolution of the Islamic theocracy in Iran. And I think part of what this election is about is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, arranging potentially for his own succession. So there's a lot of speculation that Ibrahim Raisi, the winning candidate, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or the head of their Supreme Court, is either a candidate to be the successor himself, or at least is going to go along with whoever Khamenei wants designates as his successor. There's some discussion of Khamenei's son being the successor. So I think a lot of this has to do with internal Iranian politics that we very imperfectly understand, but I'm very amused by the number of voices of people who, when the Biden administration first came into office, said, we have to hurry up and get a deal done before June 18th when the Iranian election takes place, because a hardliner will be elected.
And it's done.
And then that'll be the end of our effort to get back into the Joint Conference Plan of Action. Now, some of these very same people are saying, this is a good thing. It shows that the Supreme Leader is committed to the negotiations, and therefore we can keep negotiating because the hardliners will benefit from the lifting of sanctions, and so they're going to want to get back into the JCPOA. Of course, part of the conceit of the Biden administration's approach is that getting back into the JCPOA is meant to be a precursor of what they call a longer, stronger, better agreement that not only lengthens the time periods of restrictions of enrichment on uranium enrichment for Iran under the agreement, but also addresses some of the things left out of the previous agreement, like Iran's behavior in the region and its ballistic missile program, which was left totally uncovered. And Raisi has basically already said he has absolutely no interest in negotiating anything of the kind on those issues. So increasingly, I'm afraid it looks like getting back to the JCPOA will not be the beginning of something else, will be the end of any serious negotiations with Iran. And I think that's why, very curt comments by Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor on the Sunday shows, about it's now up to the Supreme Leader about whether they get back into the deal and whether they're willing to agree to further negotiations.
You know what strikes me listening to you, though, that we have a long, long, long tradition of getting Iran wrong.
Yes.
That there's something about the political, religious culture there that baffles American policymakers. I mean, you think of the number of cosmic blunders we have made, you know, looking for the moderates or thinking that there is an opening or not understanding what it would mean to allow the Shah to come into the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Is there something uniquely opaque about Iran, or is there something uniquely unique about our relationship with them that makes it difficult, if not impossible, for Americans to get into that mindset?
You know, it's very interesting. Ray Takei of the Council on Foreign Relations, who just has published a terrific book called The Last Shah about the fall of the Shah. It's a quite revisionist book and in a lot of ways, a terrific book. He and I wrote a small book for the Hoover Institution a couple of years ago about this. And one of the things we discovered looking back at the relationship is Iran has become, since the end of World War II, Iran in many different administrations has functioned as the sort of poster child for the administration's strategic approach to the third world. So, for instance, in 1946, there was a crisis between the United States and Iran and the Soviet Union over the Soviet Union's delayed withdrawal from Iran, which both Britain and the Soviet Union had occupied, Soviets the North, Britain the South, during World War II. And this was the beginning of President Truman's get tough policy with the Soviets after pretty conciliatory policies by President Roosevelt during the war. In the Eisenhower administration, the use of covert action to restore the Shah to the throne after the Mossadegh interlude in 1953 mm-hmm. became the harbinger of the Eisenhower administration's approach to the Third World, which was to by and large use covert action, which worked in Iran and Guatemala and to some degree in Indonesia, not quite so well in Cuba, which he handed off to John Kennedy with the results we all know. Mm-hmm. With the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, there was this huge effort to make modernization the sort of watchword of the U.S. approach in the Third World, and the Shah's white revolution to some degree became the emblematic case of that. And then the Nixon administration came in with the Nixon doctrine, which was that we were going to deputize sort of regional powers in different parts of the world to bear more of the burden so the United States could retrench after Vietnam. And the poster child, again, was the Shah's Iran. And we engaged in a series of arms sales to help support the Shah's regime play that deputy sheriff role in the Persian Gulf, which destabilized the regime and led to the revolution and the overthrow of the Shah. And as you say, we've been quite willing to see them as symbolic of an approach we've taken. I mean, since the revolution, they've become the symbol, I think, of pariah states and the U.S.'s approach to nuclear nonproliferation in pariah states. But we've never really understood what's going on inside Iran, in my view.
Okay. So let's talk about the summits. We, of course, the president just got back from the G7, and as well as the Biden-Putin summit. You had a piece for us in the Bulwark, how we will know if the Biden-Putin summit was a success and why foreign policy is not just a logical extension of personal relationships. Let's start there, because you were clearly reacting to a comment that President Biden had made that about personal relationships. You don't buy that. You don't think that foreign policy is just a logical extension of whether these guys get along with each other?
Well, first of all, to be fair to President Biden, he's not unique in my experience among presidents in thinking that his personal relationships are going to somehow transform or change things. This is actually quite a common conceit among presidents, and it's not totally wrong. As I said in the column, presentation of self to another leader at the summit has been a very important part of diplomacy since the Second World War, certainly since the rise of the conference system and with the Congress of Vienna, I suppose, in 1815. But it's not the be-all and end-all. I mean, in part because diplomacy is a technique for executing, national security policy, which is, made on the basis of interests, on geographical position, on economic concerns. There's a whole raft of things, obviously, that go into strategy. Diplomacy is just one aspect of that. And I think Biden's comment suggested a sort of, conflation. And I think he conducted himself reasonably well with Putin. But the test of the pudding is going to be in the tasting, and we'll have to see, how Putin behaves. And in that regard, both Jake Sullivan over the weekend and the president, when he had his little flap with Caitlin Collins, both suggested they have some doubts about how much change we're going to see on the part, of Putin's behavior. And that goes to the question of whether the timing of this summit made, a lot of sense. I mean, I don't think there was any grave damage done to national security by this summit, as opposed to, say, the Helsinki summit with Trump. But it'll be interesting test, and I suggested this. The president tried to put down with President Putin some markers about Russian cyber intrusions, whether they're government intrusions from the GRU into USAID or the SolarWinds hack, or whether they're these Russian-based cyber criminals who clearly are operating with the toleration of the Russian state, hacking the Colonial Pipeline. And there was even a little bit of a veiled menace on the part of Biden, saying, nice pipelines you have there, Mr. Putin. It'd be terrible if something happened to them, if something happened to ours. I'm a very suspicious, super suspicious person. If something happens to my pipeline, something might happen to yours. But he also gave him a kind of list of 16, as part of this red line exercise, a list of 16 areas of infrastructure that are kind of off limits, as he suggested. So the question is, on the one hand, if Russian attacks fall off, this will be seen, I suppose, as a pretty successful deterrent. But if we start to see Putin nibbling around the edges and saying, well, I can't touch the 16, but that means I got free rein on everything else, that could look very different.
So there was a very interesting moment, and you mentioned in your article that this petulant answer, for which he apologized later to Caitlin Collins of CNN, she's asking, do you really, trust that Putin's going to change his behavior? And Biden really pushed back on that, saying that, no, he didn't expect it. So give me your sense of that, because he seemed a little bit defensive, but also wanted to emphasize that he was not being naive about what he had accomplished with Biden at this summit.
Yeah. And, to be fair, I mean, I think from his point of view, he was putting down markers and opening up channels of communication, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the bar was so low. I mean, they're sending ambassadors back, from capitals. Of course, this all started when Biden made his comment correctly that Putin is a killer. The Russians withdrew their ambassador, Ambassador Antonov, for consultations as an indication of how poorly they took that remark. And then they did something very unusual, which is they strongly suggested to U.S. Ambassador Sullivan that he should go home for consultations as well. And he initially resisted that for a couple of days and then decided that maybe discretion was the better part of valor and came home. So now the ambassadors will go back. You know, as Churchill said, jaw is better than war. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, a fine outcome. But it's pretty minimal in terms of what was agreed. There might be some progress on some of these Americans who've been imprisoned unjustly in Russia. That would be a good thing, of course. You know, this was a kind of minimal station identification summit where Biden was sending the signal, I'm not looking to reset relations as Obama did. But I'm also not going to be, you know, a you know, boot licking ass kisser the way Donald Trump was, you know, let's see what we can do from here. So I don't think he has any, you know, great expectations, and I think they are prepared that they may have to put more sanctions on different, you know, bad actors in Russia. But of course, you know, he wanted to portray the summit as a success, and, you know, all presidents want their summits to be successful. And certainly from the limited objectives that they set, this one was more successful, I would say, than the Helsinki summit.
Well, let's talk about some of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some of the good would be that afterwards, Vladimir Putin seemed to go out of his way to say nice things about President Biden, including that, you know, sort of changing the Russian propaganda line that that Biden was doddering and senile, et cetera, saying no, he was very sharp and he was very uppity. He almost seemed to go out of his way to stress that he thought that Biden was, you know, compos mentis. What did you make of that? See, the thing about Putin is nothing's ever straightforward, is it? So it's either, hey, he was really impressed, this guy's really bright, but why does Vladimir Putin think it's in his interest to build up Joe Biden's cognitive abilities at this point?
I think it was more a question of Putin having an interest in the summit being seen as successful as well. I mean, he had an interest here also, in part because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the timing of this summit was a little odd, which is that there had been all these things that Putin had done or had been done by Russia in the run-up to the summit, as troop buildups on the eastern border of Ukraine, the very positive press coverage that Belarusian President Lukashenko got for his act of state-sponsored air piracy. You know, Putin welcomed Lukashenko to visit with him in Sochi. And I mean, he doesn't really like Lukashenko very much, but he took him out on his boat and was, you know, sort of whining and dining him, showing his support for this sort of international outlaw. So the fact that Biden extended the invitation and went through with the summit, despite all of these other things, the Colonial Pipeline hack, the food hack. It basically allowed Putin to do what he wants, which is to be seen as an equal of the United States on the world stage, a respected adversary. I mean, you know.
So by raising Biden's profile in that way, he raises his own by saying this is a worthy adversary. That means that his accomplishment is greater. So that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, part of it. I think, frankly, another part of it is we should not forget that Vladimir Putin's, you know, professional training was as a KGB case officer. Right. And KGB case officers are trained to assess their interlocutors for their strengths and their vulnerabilities in particular that can be turned to advantage. And I think in this instance, although Putin and Biden are not strangers. I mean, Putin had met Biden before as a senator and then, of course, as vice president. But this is different. You know, when you're the president of the United States, that's a different thing. And I'm sure Putin was looking at Biden to say, you know, take his sense of how much has he changed? How strong a personality is he going to be in his own right? And I think he probably was a little bit surprised that Biden was maybe a little bit sharper, a little bit better prepared than maybe had I think, anticipated. So I think that some of what he said, I think, might have been a genuine sense that, look, the guy is professional. He came prepared. He didn't mince any words. The meeting was a lot shorter than people thought. And in that sense, I think it was probably a pretty terse conversation. But I think, you know, Putin as a professional probably, you know, I think respected that. So I think you're getting some of that as well in those press conference comments. I mean, the other thing you got was a long larry of whataboutism. And
okay, that's what I was going to get to next, which was the ugly, relish with which the Russians and Putin in particular are playing the whataboutism card and basically spinning some of the disinformation about January 6th. I mean, that's kind of an extraordinary moment, isn't it? Watching him feed back some of our own domestic disinformation to us.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, I'm sure he and his colleagues couldn't be happier that, you know, all of this stuff is getting so much traction. I mean, he loves to be able to say, oh, your elections are as crooked as ours. Look at what that Arizona, you know, audit is turning up, and look at all these other things. And those poor, you know, peaceful protesters strolling through the Capitol looking for a stray, you know, glimpse of Mike Pence doing his constitutional duty, and now they're having a book thrown at him. And I know that because even Ted Cruz and others have been saying, what about, you know, the disproportion between the January 6th people and the ones arrested for Black Lives Matter protests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, it's just he's got a lot to work with, unfortunately.
And came prepared to do that. I mean, you could tell that was something that he was locked and loaded to do when he got some pretty tough questions from American reporters about his record. So now he comes armed. He wasn't being defensive about it. He was just saying, well, you know, again, look at these things that you are doing, which weirdly enough echoed the former guy's comments to Bill O'Reilly, that famous answer when Bill O'Reilly asked about Putin being a killer. And remember when Donald Trump said, well, we kill lots of people too. Because we're so great. I certainly remember a time when Republicans and conservatives hated that kind of moral equivalency. I mean, that used to be at the center of the conservative critique of the left on foreign policy.
I am old enough to remember that, Charlie.
A lot of us are. I mean, that was something that that I remember reading Bill Buckley talking about that so many years ago. So what other things should we be watching right now in terms of the rest of the world? I know you've talked about this before, but the vaccine diplomacy, major initiative by the Biden administration, how is it playing? What should we be looking to have happen next?
Well, I think, you know, the more vaccine diplomacy we can do, the better. I mean, I think the Russians and the Chinese got out a little bit, ahead of us, but their vaccines are not as good. A lot of it comes with strings attached. Again, President Biden's national security advisor in backgrounding before the president's trip talked about the steps that were taken at the G7 summit and at the US-EU summit are just the first steps. There's going to be more. And I think the more of it we can do, the better for the world, the better for us in terms of our own situation, you know, with COVID. I mean, this Delta variant that's spreading is, you know, worrisome. And until everybody in the world is vaccinated, you're going to have, you know, that problem still out there. So it's very much in our enlightened self-interest to do this.
Very much, yeah. It's almost a perfect example of enlightened self-interest, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, particularly that very much in our, because despite all the railing of the last 4 years against globalism, the reality is that pandemics tend to be global. There's no wall that protects us from them.
We live in an interconnected world and we can't pretend otherwise. And so, I give the administration a relatively high marks. They've been a little slower getting out of the blocks on this than I would have liked, but I think they've been doing the right things. I think more is coming, and that's, I think, all to the good. And in general, I think it says that I do think one of the things President Biden did well in his trip last week was he lined up, you know, the U.S. Allies and the democracies before he went to talk to Putin. He had a successful NATO summit. They're all successful, almost by design. He had a good G7 summit, a good U.S.-EU summit. He managed to sort of rally people about as much as he could, I think, to take China seriously as a threat. And he had a united front going in to see Putin again. It's not a perfect united front because of some of the allies being more willing to, do things like have the Nord Stream pipeline and that kind of thing. But he did reasonably well in the alliance management piece of Summitry, and I give him and his team credit for that.
Eric Edelman, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Eric is currently a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and served as Under Secretary of Defense for Policy from 2005 to 2009. We always appreciate it when you join us on the podcast, Ambassador.
It's always great to be with you, Charlie. If you invite me back, I'll come back.
We will definitely do that. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.